I am a poor wayfaring stranger, while traveling through this world of woe. Yet there's no sickness, toil, or danger in that bright world to which I go. I know dark clouds
and welcome to Tea Time Theology. I'm Ivy.
Hello, everyone. I'm Dwayne Keys with Church of the Redeemer.
And I'm Patrick Campbell with Church of the Redeemer.
And we are so excited to welcome Ray Watson. They are the CEO of the Providence Cultural Equity Initiative. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for the invitation. Very happy to be here today.
Yeah, absolutely. So we thought it would be helpful to sort of end this season of Tea Time Theology talking about the history of urban renewal. We've heard a lot of individual stories that were impacted by that. And now we think it might be great to have a real look into what was happening in Providence during those times.
Very good.
If you want to just jump right in with your historical knowledge, you can start wherever you think makes the most sense. You're the expert.
So for me, this is a very personal story and narrative and experience because my family, a generational, actually you could probably say we're the first peoples of Rhode Island, of Narragansett, but also with African-American heritage as well. And my family was living in this Lippitt Hill neighborhood at the time when urban renewal took place. So for those who aren't familiar, Lippitt Hill is the area where adjacent to Hope High School, where University Heights and Martin Luther King Elementary School is. One of the things that is really important, I think, to recognize is that when they talk about urban renewal, it's often been called Negro removal. That term Negro is kind of a collective term that was used for indigenous and African heritage folks who were living together at the time, who had come together to form communities. And then you can look at the history of how those communities came together. But what we found in the work that I did, and perhaps we'll talk a little bit about that later on, the work we did with the city of Providence, was that these communities, which were collectively indigenous and African heritage folks, they were targeted because of that. So you had these communities living adjacent to primarily European communities, all of the same sort of socioeconomic background, all dealing with the same challenges of trying to, you know, make your way in a society that's not necessarily supportive of people without money, without resources. But these Negro communities are targeted for urban renewal. And one of the things that they did was mislabel them as slums. And as we looked into it, you know, you have to ask the question, well, what qualifies a community as a slum? What about this community makes it a slum that you can decide to use eminent domain to take property from it? And we didn't really find any sort of qualitative data that differentiated these communities from other communities. It really just seemed to be that they were Negro communities. Now, speaking to the indigenous experience, because it's very relevant, for those who may not be familiar, in 1881, the Narragansett Indian tribe was detribalized. And when you look at the Narragansett Indian tribe, it was primarily Narragansett and Niantic people, but they were also connected to several other tribes, going all the way back to the King Philip's War in 1675-76, who had been disenfranchised from their lands and kind of pushed out of territories. They eventually begin to assimilate back into the European society at that point. And a lot of the families who were down on the reservation just simply couldn't there was no work down there. There was no real place to make a livelihood. So a lot of them moved back up to the Providence area. And as they move up to the Providence area, they're starting to interact with African heritage folks. You know, they're intermarrying, they're forming communities and all of that. And then they're purchasing land in places where there's not much development, but the land at the time is cheap. So they go and they rebuild communities in West Elmwood, in Lippitt Hill, in Upper South Providence. Mm-hmm. And if you're familiar with urban renewal...
Can you explain what urban renewal is for people who might not? We're going like real basic basics.
Okay, very good. So urban renewal is like this federal policy of pretty much trying to usher in redevelopment in areas where it was slum or blighted or just not developed properly. So on its face value, it sounds like a really great initiative. You're going to get some money. A lot of it was done through the... Federal Highway Association, I think, with funds through that. So it was like a transportation sort of thing. And it's basically targeting these underdeveloped or underutilized areas to run highways through them so that more commerce can be promoted. At this time, I think they were also promoting suburbanism and, you know, so the cars coming around. So we want people driving and, you know, we want them to be able to get into the city to work from their new places where they're living out in the suburbs. So these highways are going to be a really great opportunity for commerce and employment and all that. But of course, you have to find a place to put these highways. Mm. And one of the things that I did in my research, looking at the same time period, was look at the route that like a 95 North took and what areas the highway was allowed to go through, and more importantly, what areas it wasn't allowed to go through. And 195 was another example. And if you look at the old route for 195, and it used to blow my mind when I was younger because it like came all the way into downtown Providence, then it went east, then it went back south again, and then it like swung around the church, and then it went east again. And I used to be like, well, this doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Like, why would they? Well, when you stop to look once again at which communities were targeted during urban renewal, particularly for highways to be placed, it's the Cape Verdean community in Fox Point. It's the Negro community in Lippitt Hill. It's the Negro community in West Elmwood. Now, tying that back to the indigenous experience, once again, you detribalize. Well, first of all, you have the King Philip's War, where you're just taking the land from the indigenous folks. You have the detribalization in 1881, where you're taking more land from them and forcing them onto reservations. They're moving from the reservations up to Providence. They're connecting with African heritage folks. They're building collective communities there. And then through urban renewal under the guise of development and, you know, facilitating opportunities for car driving and suburban development, you're taking the land from these same people once again. So when you look at the spaces, and the great example I like to give is Huntington Avenue or Huntington Boulevard. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be a highway. But if you notice, like you come off of Route 10, and you go down by the car lot, maybe Rhode Island right now, down by the car lot, you come up by the 7-Eleven, and then like you just drive down this highway, but it's like a highway to nowhere. It ends.
Yeah, Niantic Ave.
Yeah, well, once again, you're utilizing federal funds, federal highway funds, mm-hmm. to target a particular community to remove them from that space. Yeah. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, the history of it is using federal highway funds to target African heritage and indigenous communities to kind of displace them under the guise of getting rid of slum and blight.
And I think it's also important to note that this was happening not only in Providence, but every major city across the United States. What I recently learned as we're digging into my own family history is that we had the highway going through the west side of Wilmington. And so a lot of those black and brown families, so my relatives included, had to move out, had their property seized because it was in the interest of, as you said, oh, that place was just deteriorating. Mm-hmm. So we're going to tell the story, you know, just the statements that were made that the outcomes are going to be better for them. So when you think about how it happened, just the deceptive practices in communication of what people were expected. So many people inadvertently went along with it on the premise that the promise was the outcomes were going to be better.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And as we now see, it was far worse.
Absolutely.
And even more worse than I think even they imagined at the time.
And to Dwayne's point, you know, when you talk about deceptive practices, the general sort of sell was that once we get done with what we're doing here, you'll have first options for it. Mm. So, okay, well, all right. If you're going to build this new complex or whatever and I get first options at it, okay, all right, I get it, you know. But you aren't told that the price is going to be three, four, however much more than what you were originally paying.
Yeah.
So they get done with it and you've got first option, but you can't afford to be there. Well, hey, that's not our fault. If you can't afford to take advantage of the first option, then I guess we'll have to move on to, and that was kind of the game plan. So I have a Juris Doctorate. I just tell people now that I graduated, don't trust the lawyers, you know, because I can see, I can just visualize lawyers sitting around a table with the policymakers saying, well, if you present it this way, then you've covered all your bases, you know. So, as Dwayne said, this was going on across the country. And I think it's so important, like I said, to understand what that term Negro represents, because these were collective communities that were coming together to form something based upon shared experiences with a society that was marginalizing and ostracizing them. Mm-hmm. Because of my shared heritage, I always like to highlight the strong bonds and relationships that were built between Indigenous folks and African heritage folks during this time, like of Jim Crow, all of that that was going on. Both of these communities were going through that. And both of these communities found ways to not only survive that, but in several instances thrive through that. And then here comes this urban renewal policy that just wipes all of that away. So if you've got communities like here in Lippitt Hill where you have doctors, lawyers, dentists, what type of doctors, lawyers, or dentists would be living in a slum?
Yeah.
You know? And once again, so how are you qualifying a slum? Because you have these professionals living in these communities amongst other folks who might not be professionals, but then if I'm a child growing up, I know a doctor, I know a lawyer that's in my neighborhood, so maybe I aspire to be that if that's not what I come from, as opposed to growing up in a neighborhood where everyone around me is just poor, there's no professionals, there's nothing to aspire to. What are my outcomes then?
And I think one of the things, too, we're talking about urban renewal, but the reality root of it is also capitalism.
Yes.
So with someone being who's worked in financial services, who's been in banking, you just talked about it, that there was all this money that had to be spent. And as we talk about this later on, like, how's this showing up today? Because you see it today. When you have development dollars and we have these programs and we have to do something with this money, and you see this all the time now with the city of Providence, that root driver of the money. We have to develop. We have to get this profit. It is so rooted in the racism that we see. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about the inherent racism of, you know what, we got to do something with this money. Who's going to be, what's the path of least resistance? Mm-hmm. What's the path of those who are not as valued, mm-hmm. if you will, in terms of what they're concerned with? Mm-hmm. It was very easy to look at the Negro communities and say, yep, we're going to put this highway right through that community. And good luck. We'll find out where you're going to be at. That's not our concern, as you said. And it was just astounding to hear some of the stories that when they developed University Heights and then there was the first right of refusal, well, again, you only have 1 to 2 bedroom apartments. Well, we need 3, 4, 5 bedroom apartments. Oh, we don't have that. Good luck.
Yep.
So just you're thinking about the driver of it, the money, that has definitely been the consistent path of driving this exclusion and the harm that's being done.
Absolutely. And you can, once again, I mean, who wants to argue that development isn't a good... You see the game that gets played? Who wants to argue that having more and better is a bad thing? So you have these sort of blanket sort of comments and statements and, you know, wrapped in this idea that it's going to be better, when in the background, very intelligent people making very specific and targeted decisions on how they're going to spend money and who is going to bear the brunt of the outcome of how that money is spent. And then when you're dealing with disenfranchised populations, you know, who knows lawyers that can fight? Who knows lawyers that can articulate? Who has relationships with politicians that can get the politicians to say, hey, wait a minute, no, that shouldn't happen. You know, if you don't have those relationships, if you don't have that power, you're done for pretty much. Because those who do have it, those who have been in these backroom conversations when the plans are going on and the decisions are being made and promise this and promise that, they're going to look at it like, well, what are they really going to do if we do it there? And once again, the flip side to that is we're going to make all of this money. There's going to be all of this development that goes on. There's going to be, I mean, I spoke to, when we were doing our interviewing for the project, one of my good friends, he's actually a judge up in Mass now, but he grew up in University Heights, and he's Caribbean. But he said, you know, looking at how things played out, even though my family would have been considered Negro, they came here to go to college and university. So we actually may have benefited from what took place with the original communities that were here. So now you're also in a space where you can bring in, the term we like to use is skin folk. Mm-hmm. You can bring skin folk into a situation with a very, very different experience and then say, well, see, it's not racist. We've got some black folks here. But these are black folks, once again, who are here because they've gotten into Brown University. So that's a different type of, if that's the proper term, type of black folk from the ones who are growing up in this community generationally, who have just always lived here on the East Side. You have, you know, always just been here for 3-4 generations. That's a different experience than someone who's had the network and the ability to get into Brown University.
Yeah. Does, and this might be a weird question, but does Brown's, like, expansion in Providence also feed into urban renewal? Because it feels like at this point, not they own, like, half of the city. Whether that's good or bad is not for me to say, but they do own a lot of land in Providence.
So, you know, and speaking as the college student who came from another state, who in ways did benefit... Because I have to acknowledge my privilege in that. Mm-hmm. I will say that now, as you look at it, it wasn't, at that moment, you're a university student. I'm here to go to college.
There you go.
Yeah. I'm living off campus. I'm just surviving myself. Mm-hmm. And so now when you look, oh, yes, they are getting all this property tax-free, mind you. Mm. And yes, you can talk about the payment in lieu of taxes, which then when you do the calculation... But I think it was their agreement, most recent agreement, was the next 20 or 30 years. Yeah. They have that set in stone. And no other future city council member can challenge that agreement. Mm. So they have it locked in that, yes, we are a benefit to Providence. And I don't want to negate the whole experience. Yes, they are. No, they are a benefit in many ways. And at the same time, there is harm that they are doing. And I want to say it's a mixture. Some of it is intentional. They know what they're doing.
Yep.
Some of it may be, you know what, again, they were, I always say that when you think of this issue of inherent racism, anyone who has understanding of the racial wealth gap is that the majority of those who have the wealth are white people. So when you make these decisions based on money, no, you may be on the surface thinking race neutral, this benefits everyone, mm-hmm. but the reality is it's what's called disparate impact. Yep. Mm-hmm. So you may not have intended yep. to harm black and brown folks, but because of the way in which you're operating in that yep. whole legacy and systems of oppression, it's now still having that same negative impact. Yep. So why is it that we have our struggling Providence public school system mm-hmm. the way that it is, and yet you have this Ivy League school, Brown University, and so why would you're sitting here struggling like, wait a minute, how can you have this very challenging school system that's linked with New Orleans and Camden, New Jersey mm-hmm. as being one of the worst school systems in the nation, with an Ivy League school right in the heart of Providence? Why isn't that university helping? And then, let's not even get started, what was that $10 million payment? It was back in 2005 or 6, they had promised that they were going to give the city of Providence or Providence Public School System money. They sure did in, what, 2020, 2021? And I sat there and I said, well, you know what? You're giving that promise later on. Is that including the lost interest and compounding for that? Oh, no, just that payment. Mm-hmm. We did our part. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of was like, leave us alone. Mm-hmm. See, we helping. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it just doesn't compare to the true value and net worth and amount of money and resources that they could be doing. Yep.
And I just want to touch base on what Dwayne shared about his experience, because I think that this talks to the systemic level of what's going on. Because why shouldn't Dwayne, who comes from similar background as young folks in Lippitt Hill, be able to come and take advantage of an education? Why shouldn't he be able to do that? Of course he should. So this is where the deviousness comes in, because knowing what Dwayne's gone through, you're now able to take Dwayne's circumstances and utilize them as a cover for what you're doing here. And the same thing for students who would go to Delaware. Yeah. Why shouldn't I be able to go to the University of Delaware and get my education? But what the University of Delaware and those folks who are impacting the Negro populations there are doing is utilizing me as justification for what they're doing there. So it becomes this like network. Yes. And I think that that's really what people have to understand, and Dwayne brought it up. This was a national policy that was going on. So we can't look at it as, well, this is just what took place in Providence. No, there was national conversations around which communities should be targeted, what the outcomes would be, and how you could effectively address those outcomes and excuse what was going on. So that's, I think, one of the main things that really needs to be understood. And when we get to talk about like the ongoing legacy of it, that's what the feeder should be. Because in the work we did, we said, well, we don't want to target our work on slavery, because then you run into those arguments. Well, no one was alive back then. And how do you, but when you look at something like urban renewal, as I mentioned, I can trace it on the indigenous side all the way back to the King Philip Swarm in 1675. And so we can do the same thing with the African heritage experience. Mm-hmm. You can trace it from slavery to disenfranchisement to Jim Crow to urban renewal. You can see the same tactics and intentions by the same groups of people playing out in different ways, but always with the same result: marginalization and disenfranchisement of this particular group of people to the financial benefit of another.
And I think another thing that's interesting to add to this conversation is also the choice to move away from like public transportation into the owning of a car as well, especially with the highway system. Mm-hmm. And I mean, well, we all still see the impacts on that.
Tie that to redlining.
Yeah.
Because soon as a Negro moves into this neighborhood, the values of the neighborhoods are going down, and I don't want to lose the value. So I'm going out to the suburbs because I can afford a car. Mm-hmm. So I'm going out here, and we're going to have predominantly white suburbs, but my job's still in the city. And I don't want to be driving through all of these back roads. It's going to take me an hour to get to work now. No, we want a highway to get there. I want to get in and get out. as fast as I can. I want to be away from those people because I don't want my housing values to go down. And I'm demanding you, my congressional representative, my senator, to do something about my needs because I shouldn't lose the value of my... All of that conversation's going on. And then here comes these highways. All of a sudden, you've got trillionaires from the auto industry because everyone's got a car now, you know. And then I think what's really interesting, and we're probably getting into contemporary, now you're starting to see a lot of these older folks who bought the houses out in the suburbs. Well, why do I have to still live in the suburbs? All of my children moved out, and I would love to be living in downtown Providence. Now, if you're familiar with the history of downtown Providence, when I was growing up, you didn't go there after dark. That was not the place to be after dark. You let the artists move in because the artists, many instances, don't have a lot of money, so they're buying and they're beautifying, and all of a sudden, downtown's the place to be. Right. Now, who primarily lives downtown? I know I can't afford to live downtown right now.
I mean, it was interesting how when I moved here, again, coming to Johnson Wells in 1999, and I moved into Snowden Hall in the heart of downtown Providence, and I can remember looking across the street, and I'm like, what's that building over there? What's Traveler's Aid? And then only a few years, 3 years afterwards, all of a sudden, that place can no longer be downtown. Mm-hmm. We got to find another spot for them to go. So then off they go past the highway into where a black and brown community for that organization to be. And let them and those who they service be over there while we redevelop this area. We got some money. We got some money, so we got to make sure we do this right and proper so that this can be a place for folks to thrive. Again, we didn't see who was it they were talking about when they talked about the folks, but they used the general terms that this was everybody, this would be great for the city. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as someone who works on anti-poverty work and how do we close the wealth gaps, part of me is like, okay, so what does that mean for those people? And I've been very good as I've gotten older, as it's particularly for the black and brown folks, and particularly for the folks who live here, how are they going to directly benefit? We don't always ask those questions. Yep. So things are being presented as a whole, as a city. And so we have to be very honest. Yep. Well, the city is not doing things to benefit everybody.
Yes.
Only a select few of folks.
Yes.
So if this is beneficial to everyone, show me how.
Absolutely. And I think Dwayne's point is so key. Dwayne Key's point is okay. I think we, as representatives of these communities that have been historically marginalized, disenfranchised, we have to be more strategic and more intentional in our conversations. I think that part of the problem has been this notion that what's good for everyone will be good for us. And we just want an opportunity, you know, and a seat at the table. And all of those buzzwords that have been utilized that I don't need, they're just in one ear and out the other with me now. Because what does that exactly mean for me and my community? I don't want to hear that downtown development is going to benefit Providence. Which Providence?
Right.
You know, who in Providence is it going to benefit? Because I'm not foolish enough to believe that we're all the same Providence. Once again, and this, I recall maybe about 10 years ago, there was all of this conversation around rezoning. Mm-hmm. And it still blows my mind to this day. Former Councilman Kevin Jackson wanted to pull in some of the neighborhoods over in North End because before 95 North went through it, they were all connected. If you're familiar with kind of some of the social issues going on in the city right now, there's a generational rivalry going on between here and the East Side and Chad Brown. But when I was growing up, and for the generations before that, those communities were like this before the highway got run through it and they got separated by a highway. So he wanted to pull some of the homes and residences on the other side of the highway over into Ward 3. They were similar socioeconomic status as right here in Mount Hope. And the argument was no, because they couldn't jump natural barriers, and they considered the highway to be a natural barrier. which, okay. But then simultaneously, Fox Point jumped the Meshassic River to take in downtown. And it was like, how is the river not a natural barrier, but the highway is? Mm-hmm. So when we look at, once again, these policies and these choices that are made and who's impacted, we can't expand the ward to include more people who are the same socioeconomic status as the people on this side, because that's a larger voting block, right? And what if they all vote in their own interest, not in the interest of the city? But we can jump it to pull in downtown where all of the commercial development's going, to connect it with a community that's highly affluent, highly resourced, highly networked. Why? Because it benefits Providence. So it's like this double speak that's going on all the time.
And along with that, with the ward boundaries, you know, redrawn, which we just went through, but went through again 10 years ago, at the same time, just as you said, what they did with Fox Point, Ward 11, which was again predominantly black and brown, and had parts of downtown Providence, all of a sudden they said, well, you know what, those parts of downtown Providence, we need to combine those with the Fox Point area, because they're all one together collective. So you guys, you can just stay over the highway. You don't need to worry about that area. It's going to be it'll be easier, as the term was used, for combining those areas together as a particular political jurisdiction. It'll be easier. They didn't say how, but it was going to be easier in terms of grouping those areas together.
And if I could, just the lawyers... What does easier mean, and easier for who? Because it most certainly has been easier for someone. Mm-hmm. But who is it going to be easier
and
for?
And as the banker, I can say, look, we try to spend this money, okay? We ain't got time for all that red tape. We need to get these loans and this interest payments. Yeah. We need to make this money. And that's the other thing, for the listeners, I am a capitalist. I want that money. But I also want everyone else to be able to benefit, too.
There you go.
Yeah. Everyone has to have some sort of benefit and gain from what we're doing in this initiative. If I am doing harm, I'm sorry, I have a conscience. I can't do something that I know is knowingly going to do such harm. And yet, as you saw back then with the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and so on, you still have people who have a lack of conscience in what they're doing. Or because it doesn't directly impact them. Yeah. As we saw, they weren't living here. So they can make those decisions, go to whichever community that they were living in, while all of us who were living here at that time had to just bear the brunt of it.
Yep. And I do want to acknowledge that as well. I think a large part of the pushback is often from people who are benefiting. Well, that's not what we intended or we didn't know. And I get it. And I respect it. But that doesn't excuse the harm that's done. And I think that if people try to focus on what their intentions are rather than what the outcome is, we're always going to be in an issue. You know, if I go to a doctor and he doesn't intend to amputate my arm, but that's what ends up happening, I don't have an arm. Cool that you didn't mean to, but I don't have an arm now. And I think it's that logic we need to apply to when we're looking at initiatives and policy that impacts particular communities. Your intention might be good for you, but it does nothing for the people that are harmed and disenfranchised and marginalized by the outcomes of what takes place.
Yeah, I mean, really, I always say there's intent and then there's impact. Mm-hmm. And you could have the best of intentions, but if your impact was this, that's really what it comes down to. Mm-hmm. It. And so part of what we see with policy, and as we can see then, as it happens today, the focus is on intent. This is what we're trying to do versus, is this what we want to have happen?
Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's a great place to pause because we're starting to talk about intention and how it's impacting us today. And that's going to be our next episode. So thank you so much for starting this conversation. And Ray, if we wanted to connect with you or support the work that you're doing, how would people do that?
Sure. So you can check out the Providence Cultural Equity Initiative's website, www.provci.org. And if you want to communicate or touch base, hello, @provci.org. We've got some really good things going on, which I think in the next episode I'll be able to talk a little bit more about. But yeah, check us out through our website.
Yeah, absolutely. And Dwayne and Patrick, I'll let you guys plug your world as well real quick.
Great. Well, this has been an excellent experience. At Redeemer, we do have our racial reconciliation and anti-racism ministry and network that's going on. So this conversation is just part of the many projects and focuses that we're having on how do we have a closer, loving community that's healing and reconciling these harmful yet very informative and educational experiences.
And I would just add to that, Dwayne, that part of that intentional work we're doing is also exactly the conversation we're having now, learning history, bringing to light untold stories, hearing from people who have not been heard from through the generations. So here at Redeemer, we are really committed and actively engaged in learning what has happened here in Mount Hope and the parish's role in that and uncovering those stories and histories so that then we can move into a new and better and reconciled future.
Cool. And is there like a Facebook page that people could go to learn about that? We have parish
website, we have parish Facebook page, so you can find us. And you'll be hearing more about our ongoing oral history project. It will be unveiled later in the year, and there'll be many public announcements about that, and we'll be sharing that widely. But great. It's not ready yet. It's in process.
Thank you all so much.
I'm going there to see my father. I'm going there no more to roam. I'm only going over Jordan. I'm only going over home. I'm going there to see my Savior, to sing his praise forevermore. I'm only
thank you for listening to Tea Time Theology, a ministry of St. John's Cathedral in Rhode Island. We would like to thank our producers, Ivy Swinsky and Taylor Wilkie. Special thanks to Mario Akande and David Hines for this season's music. Additionally, we would like to thank Dwayne Keyes for co-hosting this season and the Reverend Patrick Campbell for consulting this season. Our sponsor, the Episcopal Diocese of Rhode Island, and the Right Reverend Nicholas Nisley, as well as our guests today. Follow us at Tea Time Theology on all social medias.